A couple of years ago, the senior high group visited St. Paul's Baptist Church, an historically African American church in Boise. We sang that song that we just sang, Lift Every Voice and Sing, sometimes called the Black National Anthem. They sing it slower than we've often sung it here at Booth. I think Carrie slowed it down so that we could all get all of the words out. They sing it mournful, certainly not triumphant. It gave me time to reflect on the violent history these lyrics chronicle and that culminate in the harmonies of liberty. But are the sounds of liberty really harmonious? Seems more like cacophony. Certainly it has been cacophonous these last 2 weeks as the events in Paris brought the inherent tensions of free speech into focus. In fact, it is very hard to lift every voice, to ask or force someone to refrain from assertively taking control so that we might tease out the voices of the timid, to give voice to the angry, lest they take their anger out in violent acts. And yet, if we would create beloved community, this is something that we must learn to do. What does it take to encourage every voice to sing? Perhaps harder yet, what does it take to create a community that listens respectfully to every voice? I can't speak about community on a global scale. I know that we need satirists to challenge power and to skewer folly. And so I decry limits on speech. And yet, I know how destructive satire can be in a small community attempting to lift every voice. So today, I'm talking only about trying to create beloved community on the scale of a church, or say, a classroom, perhaps a city, maybe even a state. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. certainly believed in the vision of beloved community on a national scale. It's awfully hard to imagine, though. How do I contribute to creating a beloved community to solve the issue of school funding, for example, with legislators who are hostile to public school teachers? Some would say that only an adversarial approach can work. Only lawsuits and the hostile parry and thrust of letters to the editor will work. And these are necessary and play a vital role. But Dr. King had some strategies that involve a more intimate approach to problem solving and more transformative. He wasn't aiming to vanquish an enemy. He was aiming for redemption. So at the root of his strategies, then, there is nothing less than love. The year was 1963, 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. The month was April. In 5 years, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would be dead. But in April of 1963, he was in jail in Birmingham, Alabama, trying to revive a stalled civil rights movement. The strategists of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or SCLC as it was known, had chosen Birmingham as the site of their next civil disobedience project. They were committed to nonviolence, but they were not about to wait for the democratic process. Birmingham had just experienced yet another unsolved bombing of a black institution. This time it was a church, and four little girls had died. Everyone knew the KKK was involved, but Bull Connor was the commissioner of public safety, and his record of solving suspicious bombings was itself suspect. The leaders of SCLC chose Birmingham to stage their next protest against segregation because they could count on Bull Connor to overplay his hand. He was an outspoken and unapologetic segregationist, and King believed Connor would probably meet the peaceful demonstrations with an overbearing and violent response. He did. His weapons were fire hoses and barely restrained dogs. His victims were strategically chosen African-American children as young as 10, all dressed in their Sunday school clothes. He arrested and jailed 3,000 children and youths who refused to answer violence with violence. They had spiritually prepared to accept the violence. They had practiced and role-played and prayed. When Americans saw Connor's brutal tactics on the nightly news, they could be bystanders no more, and they demanded that Congress put a stop to segregation laws. The movement was revitalized, and within a year, the Civil Rights Act passed. By 1968, King had begun to connect the dots between what he called the triple evils: poverty, racism, militarism. In April of that year, he was assassinated, the culmination of a decade of assassinations. His last speech was delivered the night before. He had been receiving many death threats, and he seemed to predict his own death. "Like anybody," King spoke, "I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." He was assassinated the next day. In the preceding months, legislation was introduced seeking to make his birthday, January 15th, a federal holiday, but it was opposed by a majority of Republicans. In 1979, another attempt went down by 5 votes. Finally, in 1983, President Reagan signed federal legislation, bowing to the pressure of 6 million letters. But still, many states refused to recognize the holiday. In 1989, the NFL selected Tempe, Arizona to host the 1993 Super Bowl on the condition that it adopt a King holiday. Those of you who plan on worshiping at the Church of Green Bay versus Seattle this afternoon can feel good about those efforts, especially since the attention cast light on the fact that states like Idaho had not yet passed its own legislation honoring this man who believed in America's ultimate goodness. In 1990, Governor Cecil Andrus signed compromise legislation making Idaho the 47th state to honor King, albeit under the title of Idaho Human Rights Day, so as not to single out Dr. King for honor. As Unitarian minister Theodore Parker said, and as Dr. King often repeated, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." I said that Dr. King was jailed when he went to Birmingham. He had been arrested for violating the law that prohibited mass public protests. While in jail, he began writing his now famous Letter from Birmingham Jail, which he wrote in response to 8 white clergymen who published an open letter complaining about the unwise and untimely methods of the SCLC and urging their Negro citizens to withdraw their support for the movement. They said King was an outside agitator meddling in a local matter. In his response to their letter, which, by the way, he had to start by writing on the margins of the newspaper because they refused to give him paper. In his response to their letter, King addressed his fellow clergymen and established his bona fides for being there. He was invited by the local affiliate of SCLC, of which he was president. But he extends his credentials when he says, "I am in Birmingham because injustice is here." And then, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Next, King goes on to establish the idea that anyone in power never thinks it is time to give up power. It is never timely. Hence the need for nonviolent direct action, an idea King adapted from reading Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience. The letter continues as King describes what nonviolent confrontation entails. First, one must establish the facts. Second, one then attempts negotiation. Third, one has to be willing to undergo self-purification. And then and only then does one engage in direct action. Self-purification is the least easily articulated of all of his ideas. It is the spiritual work that each individual must do in order to engage in any of the other elements. It is the self-work that one must do in order to love your enemy. It is the thing you must do to negotiate in good faith, even if your opponent won't. The King philosophy states that a self-purified person follows this protocol: using grace, humor, and intelligence, confront the other party with a list of injustices and a plan for addressing and resolving these injustices. Look for what is positive in every action and statement the opposition makes. Do not seek to humiliate the opponent, but to call forth the good in the opponent. Using grace, humor, and intelligence, you mean I can't use meanness, guile, sarcasm, and violent language meant to demean my opponent? You probably have to practice this behavior in your business encounters every day, or your ministry work right here at Booth. I have often failed to live up to this standard. Please forgive me. While I don't consider my students my opponents by any stretch, I have to follow this in the classroom as well. For I do experience some of their ideas and opinions as threats to my very being. I would like to respond with satire, trust me. And yet, I am morally obligated to respond with grace, humility, and intelligence. This is sometimes very, very hard and requires a lot from the better angel of my nature. If you think about it, you can replace a few words, and King describes what I am asked to do in my classroom. Using grace, humor, and intelligence, confront your students with provocative ideas that might challenge their beliefs and assumptions about the world. Look for what is positive in every statement the student makes. Do not seek to humiliate the students, but to call forth the good in their thinking and reasoning. In fact, teachers in my district will now be evaluated based on their ability to engage students in discussions of substantive issues and to create an environment where all voices are lifted, heard, and respected. We can no longer allow the kid in the corner not to speak. Here's what is required of teachers today, according to the Danielson model of teacher evaluation. Teachers' questions are of uniformly high quality with adequate time for students to respond. Students formulate many questions. Number two, students assume considerable responsibility for the success of the discussions, initiating topics and making unsolicited contributions. And number three, students themselves ensure that all voices are heard in the discussion. We are being asked to create an environment to model the behaviors and to set the expectation that students will create a community where all voices are heard. As such, we are being asked to overcome some pretty ingrained bad habits of human communication and to replace them with attention, tolerance, and respect. I think Martin Luther King would be pleased, like maybe we are climbing that mountain he spoke of. Our district just announced this new criteria, and I might have been intimidated by the thought of having to learn how to do this were it not for my fortuitous association with a friend and mentor, Dr. Jeff Wilhelm, director of the Boise State Writing Project. In 7 years, I have never heard him belittle someone's ideas or opinions, nor impugn someone's motives. And this is not because he has no opponents with whom he disagrees. He has plenty of opponents he's trying to influence sensible education policy. But he always starts from the fundamental belief that we can find common ground about ultimate goals. He acts without guile in all of his encounters. Every year, 20 or so teachers go through a fellowship program run by Dr. Wilhelm, and in it they learn how to create a classroom environment that lifts every voice. I know, it's only 20 a year. They investigate and learn what words, what practices, and what approaches to instruction contribute to a welcoming environment that entrusts students with the responsibility of developing their own voice and honoring the other voices in the classroom. This is the future of education. We are moving away from the information transmission model to one that, more than any other model, resembles what Dr. King had in mind when he envisioned beloved community. It is not easy. Let me give you an example. I am required to teach seminal texts in American Letters. King's letter from a Birmingham jail is one of them. And while my students are familiar with segregation and the civil rights movement from their history classes, in English, we are to look at his word choices, his rhetoric, his tone, the choices he makes in structure, and its effects on his intended audience. I know from experience that many students think the racial thing is over, that we've made as much progress as we can, and that there is no reason to continue to discuss the civil rights movement. So here's how I tried to engage them with the ideas so that we might have an honest, respectful conversation about human rights. I introduced the topic by showing them an old black and white photo of an African-American boy, about 8 or 9, holding a white baby doll while a black baby doll sits beside him on a table. I've learned to always introduce a difficult text or concept with a picture so that even my less competent readers can participate. This is only polite, but teachers were never trained to be concerned about being polite. It was mainly about maintaining control in the classroom. That's changing. In the picture, an African-American adult is observing the boy. I asked the students to form an hypothesis about what is going on. We learn that it is a photo of an experiment demonstrating this disheartening truth that African Americans identified white baby dolls as good and preferred them to the black baby dolls. This demonstrated that segregation created in its victims feelings of inferiority, similar to how abuse victims internalize a sense of unworthiness. The lawyers in Brown versus Board of Education wanted to demonstrate that the doctrine of separate but equal, enshrined in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, was indeed harmful to the colored populations from which white people wished to be segregated. We then watched a 10-minute documentary on Buell Connor. We read the complaint of the 8 clergymen, and finally, we approached the rather intimidating letter from a Birmingham jail. In the letter, Dr. King argues the difference between a just law, which must be obeyed, and an unjust law, which morally must be challenged. We learned that his criteria for an unjust law is any law that degrades personality. We had to unpack what that meant, and we agreed that it was any law that attempted to make a person feel less than. Then I listed all of the groups that are currently protected by the Idaho Human Rights Statute from being considered less than. You cannot deny housing, service, or employment to anyone based on race, color, national origin, gender, religion, and thanks to federal law, disability status. We talked about what this anti-discrimination would mean for a dentist, a cake baker, a landlord, a minister. I explained how various situations might play out in the real world, and I explained the difference in how the law applied to business enterprises versus religious enterprises. Then I wrote on the whiteboard that in Idaho, it is legal today to deny service, employment, and housing on account of sexual orientation and gender identity. Yes, I went there. We discussed whether the law degraded the personhood of certain individuals in our community whose sexual expression differed from the majority. Based on Dr. King's criteria, a majority of students agreed that the law was an unjust law, and the four words should be added to the statute. But some students just could not allow it in the realm of possibility to admit that the law was unjust. One boy said, politely, that gays, by their behavior, had already degraded themselves, and so it was not the responsibility of society to make their behavior legal. Of course, he was not so articulate, but I helped him to put his ideas into words. Should I not have? Should I have let him stammer in confusion? His opinions were acid in my mouth. Another student said that society would be degraded if we normalized, my word, homosexual behavior. Should I not have helped her articulate her ideas? Because she was able to give voice to her beliefs, another student was able to challenge her, asking if she based her ideas on her religion. She said yes, she did base her views on her religion's teachings. Other students rebutted that we are supposed to have separation of church and state. Many expressed discomfort that a single religion would get to define what is good for society. It was a very civil discussion. I was pleased that students in the minority felt free to express their deep concerns about, again, my words, normalizing homosexual behavior. But in the end, over 75% of students agreed that the legislature should amend the law to add the words. Even some students uncomfortable with the idea of homosexuality agreed that the law as it stands now is unjust. But there were some who would not change their opinions. I then brought up that the legislature might add the words if they could carve out an exemption for religious reasons. Some of the more religious students were happy with this compromise, and they could overcome their objection to amending the law. But others pointed out that we would then see signs saying, "No gays allowed," and how would that be different than the segregated lunch counters of the 1950s? I was truly amazed that so many students had spoken. Was I pleased that there were even a few students who would demean a group of citizens and deny them their rights? Not at all. But I felt that we had tried to uphold our commitments to lift every voice. But I also knew that I have students who are gay in those classes, and yet they did not feel safe enough to announce their sexual identities or orientations. But then again, this extremely conservative school culture has definitely grown more accepting of gay students over time. At the end of the class, I asked, was every voice heard that wanted to be heard? I checked for the thumbs up sign, and they were all up, except one. As the students were filing out the door, Lucas came up to me, and he was shaking. He pointed to the board and practically spit out that he disagreed. With that, he pointed to the whiteboard where I had written King's criteria for just and unjust laws. And that, he pointed to where I had framed the question, is this law just? I had to help him articulate what it was he objected to because he could not explain it. I finally got from him that he understood that homosexuality identity is a choice, and so it did not equate with discrimination based on things you were born into, like race or country of origin. I politely and genuinely asked him why he did not raise this point during our discussion. Had he felt silenced? He said he couldn't put his thoughts into words at the time. I asked him if he'd like to write something down and present it to the class. I asked, he would. He said he had proof that homosexuality is a choice. Now, it would do no good to argue with him. It's not my role. So I insisted that he also research counterarguments with an open mind and include those in any statement he makes before the class. We'll see what he writes next week. There's only one class meeting left. This community we have created will be dissolved after next week. I will get a different composition of 180 students, and we'll have to try again to create a safe place to lift every voice. I don't think the legislators have a clue that this is what we do in school. Those legislators are not evil, but they're probably misinformed and have an archaic model in their heads. How might we help them work towards a mutually satisfying solution to school reform among the many pressing issues facing our state? Is there a way to build trusting relationships among all the concerned agents? And what is the role of satire in trying to affect social change? When do we scold? When do we educate? My experience tells me that the only thing that works in the long run is love and good manners. And playing the believing game, as Professor Wilhelm suggests, believe that everyone has the best interests at heart. This building beloved community is hard, lifelong work. It is the work of people who love and who daily work on the habits of love. Here at Booth, there is a new small group ministry, a chalice circle forming called Creating Compassionate Community. If you want to practice the art of nonviolent communication, where you will learn to practice the habits of love, please sign up with Lars Bergeson or Louise Jacobson. Their contact information is in the order of service. You may achieve the feeling expressed in our reading. Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person and having neither to weigh thoughts nor measure words. May we create a truly beloved community committed to helping each other grow in love.